NBA stars than single-parent, poor families. The more data we can throw at this question, the better. Then I remembered one more data point that can provide telling clues to a man's background. It was suggested in a paper by two economists, Roland Fryer and Stephen Levitt, that a black person's first name is an indication of his socioeconomic background. Fryer and Levitt studied birth certificates in California in the 1980s and found that among African Americans, poor, uneducated, and single moms tend to give their kids different names than do middle-class, educated, and married parents. Kids from better-off backgrounds are more likely to be given common names such as Kevin, Chris, and John. Kids from difficult homes in the projects are more likely to be given unique names such as Noshan, Unique, and Breon Shea. African-American kids born into poverty are nearly twice as likely to have a name that is given to no other child born in that same year. So what about the first names of black NBA players? Do they sound more like middle-class or poor blacks? Looking at the same time period, California-born NBA players were half as likely to have unique names as the average black male, a statistically significant difference. Know someone who thinks the NBA is a league for kids from the ghetto? Tell him to just listen closely to the next game on the radio. Tell him to note how frequently Russell dribbles past Dwight and then tries to slip the ball past the outstretched arms of Josh and into the waiting hands of Kevin. If the NBA really were a league filled with poor black men, it would sound quite different. There would be a lot more men with names like LeBron. Now we have gathered three different pieces of evidence, the county of birth, the marital status of the mothers of the top scorers, and the first names of players. No source is perfect, but all three support the same story. Better socioeconomic status means a higher chance of making the NBA. The conventional wisdom, in other words, is wrong. Among all African Americans born in the 1980s, about 60% had unmarried parents, but I estimate that among African Americans born in that decade who reached the NBA, a significant majority had married parents. In other words, the NBA is not composed primarily of men with backgrounds like that of LeBron James. There are more men like Chris Bosh, raised by two parents in Texas, who cultivated his interest in electronic gadgets, or Chris Paul, the second son of middle-class parents in Louisville, North Carolina, whose family joined him on an episode of Family Feud in 2011. The goal of a data scientist is to understand the world. Once we find the counterintuitive result, we can use more data science to help us explain why the world is not as it seems. Why, for example, do middle-class men have an edge in basketball relative to poor men? There are at least two explanations. First, because poor men tend to end up shorter. Scholars have long known that childhood health care and nutrition play a large role in adult health. This is why the average man in the developed world is now 4 inches taller than a century and a half ago. Data suggests that Americans from poor backgrounds, due to weaker early life health care and nutrition, are shorter. Data can also tell us the effect of height on reaching the NBA. You undoubtedly intuited that being tall can be of assistance to an aspiring basketball player. Just contrast the height of the typical ball player on the court to the typical fan in the stands. The average NBA player is 6'7". The average American man is 5'9". How much does height matter? NBA players sometimes fib a little about their height, and there is no listing of the complete height distribution of American males. But working with a rough mathematical estimate of what this distribution might look like and the NBA's own numbers, it is easy to confirm that the effects of height are enormous, maybe even more than we might have suspected. I estimate that each additional inch roughly doubles your odds of making it to the NBA, and this is true throughout the height distribution. A 5'11" man has twice the odds of reaching the NBA as a 5'10" man. A 6'11" man has twice the odds of reaching the NBA as a 6'10" man. It appears that among men less than 6 feet tall, only about 1 in 2 million reach the NBA. Among those over 7 feet tall, I and others have estimated something like 1 in 5 reach the NBA. Data, you will note, clarifies why my dream of basketball stardom was derailed. It was not because I was brought up in the suburbs. It was because I am 5'9" and white, not to mention slow. Also, I am lazy, and I have poor stamina, awful shooting form, and occasionally a panic attack when the ball gets in my hand. A second reason that boys from tough backgrounds may struggle to make the NBA is that they sometimes lack certain social skills. Using data on thousands of school children, economists have found that middle-class, two-parent families are on average substantially better at raising kids who are trusting, disciplined, persistent, focused, and organized. So how do poor social skills derail an otherwise promising basketball career? Let's look at the story of Doug Wren, one of the most talented basketball prospects in the 1990s. His college coach, Jim Calhoun at the University of Connecticut, who has trained future NBA All-Stars, claimed Wren jumped the highest of any man he had ever worked with. But Wren had a challenging upbringing. He was raised by a single mother in Blood Alley, one of the roughest neighborhoods in Seattle. In Connecticut, he consistently clashed with those around him. He would taunt players, question coaches, and wear loose-fitting clothes in violation of team rules. He also had legal troubles. He stole shoes from a store and snapped to police officers. Calhoun finally had enough and kicked him off the team. Wren got a second chance at the University of Washington, but there, too, an inability to get along with people derailed him. He fought with his coach over playing time and shot selection and was kicked off this team as well. Wren went undrafted by the NBA, bounced around lower leagues, moved in with his mother, and was eventually imprisoned for assault. "My career is over," Wren told the Seattle Times in 2009. "My dreams, my aspirations are over. Doug Wren is dead. That basketball player, that dude is dead. It's over." Wren had the talent not just to be an NBA player, but to be a great, even a legendary player. But he never developed the temperament to even stay on a college team. Perhaps if he'd had a stable early life, he could have been the next Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, of course, also had an impressive vertical leap, plus a large ego and intense competitiveness, a personality at times that was not unlike Wren's. Jordan could be a difficult kid. At the age of 12, he was kicked out of school for fighting, but he had at least one thing that Wren lacked, a stable, middle-class upbringing. His father was an equipment supervisor for General Electric, his mother a banker, and they helped him navigate his career. In fact, Jordan's life is filled with stories of his family guiding him away from the traps that a great competitive talent can fall into. After Jordan was kicked out of school, his mother responded by taking him with her to work. He was not allowed to leave the car and instead had to sit there in the parking lot reading books. After he was drafted by the Chicago Bulls, his parents and siblings took turns visiting him to make sure he avoided the temptations that come with fame and money. Jordan's career did not end like Wren's, with a little red quote in the Seattle Times. It ended with a speech upon induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame that was watched by millions of people. In his speech, Jordan said he tried to stay focused on the good things about life. You know, how people perceive you, how you respect them, how you're perceived publicly. Take a pause and think about the things that you do. And that all came from my parents. The data tells us Jordan is absolutely right to thank his middle-class married parents. The data tells us that in worse-off families, in worse-off communities, there are NBA-level talents who are not in the NBA. These men had the genes, had the ambition, but never developed the temperament to become basketball superstars. And no, whatever we might intuit, being in circumstances so desperate that basketball seems a matter of life or death does not help. Stories like that of Doug Wren can help illustrate this, and data proves it. In June 2013, LeBron James was interviewed on television after winning his second NBA championship. He has since won a third. "I'm LeBron James," he announced, "from Akron, Ohio, from the inner city. I am not even supposed to be here." Twitter and other social networks erupted with criticism. How could such a supremely gifted person, identified from an absurdly young age as the future of basketball, claim to be an underdog? In fact, anyone from a difficult environment, no matter his athletic prowess, has the odds stacked against him. James's accomplishments, in other words, are even more exceptional than they appear to be at first. Data proves that, too.
Part 2. The Powers of Big Data. 2. Was Freud right? I recently saw a person walking down a street described as a penistrian. You caught that, right? A penistrian instead of a pedestrian? I saw it in a large data set of typos people make. A person sees someone walking and writes the word penis. Has to mean something, right? I recently learned of a man who dreamed of eating a banana while walking to the altar to marry his wife. I saw it in a large data set of dreams people record on an app. A man imagines marrying a woman while eating a phallic-shaped food. That also has to mean something, right? Was Sigmund Freud right? Since his theories first came to public attention, the most honest answer to this question would be a shrug. It was Karl Popper, the Austrian-British philosopher, who made this point clearest. Popper famously claimed that Freud's theories were not falsifiable. There was no way to test whether they were true or false. Freud could say the person writing about penistrian was revealing a possibly repressed sexual desire. The person could respond that she wasn't revealing anything, that she could have just as easily made an innocent typo such as pedaltrian. It would be a he said, she said situation. Freud could say the gentleman dreaming of eating a banana on his wedding day was secretly thinking of a penis, revealing his desire to really marry a man rather than a woman. The gentleman could say he just happened to be dreaming of a banana. He could have just as easily been dreaming of eating an apple as he walked to the altar. It would be he said, he said. There was no way to put Freud's theory to a real test. Until now, that is. Data science makes many parts of Freud falsifiable. It puts many of his famous theories to the test. Let's start with phallic symbols in dreams. Using a huge data set of recorded dreams, we can readily note how frequently phallic-shaped objects appear. Food is a good place to focus this study. It shows up in many dreams, and many foods are shaped like phalluses. Bananas, cucumbers, hot dogs, etc. We can then measure the factors that might make us dream more about certain foods than others, how frequently they are eaten, how tasty most people find them, and yes, whether they are phallic in nature. We can test whether two foods, both of which are equally popular, but one of which is shaped like a phallus, appear in dreams in different amounts. If phallus-shaped foods are no more likely to be dreamed about than other foods, then phallic symbols are not a significant factor in our dreams. Thanks to big data, this part of Freud's theory may indeed be falsifiable. I received data from Shadow, an app that asks users to record their dreams. I coded the foods included in tens of thousands of dreams. Overall, what makes us dream of foods? The main predictor is how frequently we consume them. The substance that is most dreamed about is water. The top 20 foods include chicken, bread, sandwiches, and rice, all notably un-Freudian. The second predictor of how frequently a food appears in dreams is how tasty people find it. The two foods we dream about most often are the notably un-Freudian but famously tasty chocolate and pizza. So what about phallic-shaped foods? Do they sneak into our dreams with unexpected frequency? Nope. Bananas are the second most common fruit to appear in dreams, but they are also the second most commonly consumed fruit, so we don't need Freud to explain how often we dream about bananas. Cucumbers are the seventh most common vegetable to appear in dreams. They are the seventh most consumed vegetable, so again, their shape isn't necessary to explain their presence in our minds as we sleep. Hot dogs are dreamed of far less frequently than hamburgers. This is true even controlling for the fact that people eat more burgers than dogs. Overall, using a regression analysis, a method that allows social scientists to tease apart the impact of multiple factors across all fruits and vegetables, I found that a food's being shaped like a phallus didn't give it more likelihood of appearing in dreams than would be expected by its popularity. This theory of Freud's is falsifiable, and at least according to my look at the data, false. Next, consider Freudian slips. The psychologist hypothesized that we use our errors, the ways we misspeak or miswrite, to reveal our subconscious desires, frequently sexual. Can we use big data to test this? Here's one way. See if our errors, our slips, lean in the direction of the naughty. If our buried sexual desires sneak out in our slips, there should be a disproportionate number of errors that include words like penis, cock, and sex. This is why I studied a dataset of more than 40,000 typing errors collected by Microsoft researchers. The dataset included mistakes that people make but then immediately correct. In these tens of thousands of errors, there were plenty of individuals committing errors of a sexual sort. There was the aforementioned penistrian. There was also someone who typed sexurity instead of security and cocks instead of rocks. But there were also plenty of innocent slips. People wrote of pindos and vegetables, aftermoons and refrigerators. So was the number of sexual slips unusual? To test this, I first used the Microsoft dataset to model how frequently people mistakenly switch particular letters. I calculated how often they replace a T with an S, a G with an H. I then created a computer program that made mistakes in the way that people do. We might call it ErrorBot. ErrorBot replaced a T with an S with the same frequency that humans in the Microsoft study did. It replaced a G with an H as often as they did, and so on. I ran the program on the same words people had gotten wrong in the Microsoft study. In other words, the bot tried to spell pedestrian and rocks, windows, and refrigerator. But it switched an R with a T as often as people do, and wrote, for example, tox. It switched an R with a C as often as humans do, and wrote cox. So what do we learn from comparing ErrorBot with normally careless humans? After making a few million errors just from misplacing letters in the ways that humans do, ErrorBot had made numerous mistakes of a Freudian nature. It misspelled seashell as sexshell, lipstick as lipstick, and luckiest as fuckiest, along with many other similar mistakes. And here's the key point, ErrorBot, which of course does not have a subconscious, was just as likely to make errors that could be perceived as sexual as real people were. With the caveat, as we social scientists like to say, that there needs to be more research, this means that sexually oriented errors are no more likely for humans to make than can be expected by chance. In other words, for people to make errors such as penistrian, sexurity, and cox, it's not necessary to have some connection between mistakes and the forbidden, some theory of the mind where people reveal their secret desires via their errors. These slips of the fingers can be explained entirely by the typical frequency of typos. People make lots of mistakes, and if you make enough mistakes, eventually you start saying things like lipstick, fuckiest, and penistrian. If a monkey types long enough, he will eventually write to be or not to be. If a person types long enough, she will eventually write penistrian. Freud's theory that errors reveal our subconscious wants is indeed falsifiable, and according to my analysis of the data, false. Big data tells us a banana is always just a banana, and a penistrian, just a misspelled pedestrian. So is Freud totally off target in all his theories? Not quite. When I first got access to Pornhub data, I found a revelation there that struck me as at least somewhat Freudian. In fact, this is among the most surprising things I have found yet during my data investigations. A shocking number of people visiting mainstream porn sites are looking for portrayals of incest. Of the top 100 searches by men on Pornhub, one of the most popular porn sites, 16 are looking for incest-themed videos. Fair warning, this is going to get a little graphic. They include brother and sister, stepmom fuck son, mom and son, mom fuck son, and real brother and sister. The plurality of male incestuous searches are for scenes featuring mothers and sons. And women? 9 of the top 100 searches by women on Pornhub are for incest-themed videos, and they feature similar imagery, though with the gender of any parent and child who is mentioned, usually reversed. Thus, the plurality of incestuous searches made by women are for scenes featuring fathers and daughters. It's not hard to locate in this data at least a faint echo of Freud's Oedipal complex. He hypothesized a near-universal desire in childhood, which is later repressed, for sexual involvement with opposite-sex parents. If only the Viennese psychologist had lived long enough to turn his analytic skills to Pornhub data, where interest in opposite-sex parents seems to be borne out by adults with great explicitness and little is repressed. Of course, Pornhub data can't tell us for certain who people are fantasizing about when watching such videos. Are they actually imagining having sex with their own parents? Google searches can give some more clues that there are plenty of people with such desires. Consider all searches of the form, I want to have sex with my... dot dot dot. The number one way to complete this search is mom. Overall, more than 3/4% of searches of this form are incestuous, and this is not due to the particular phrasing. Searches of the form, I am attracted to... dot dot dot, for example, are even more dominated by admissions of incestuous desires. Now, I concede, at the risk of disappointing Herr Freud, that these are not particularly common searches. A few thousand people every year in the United States admitting an attraction to their mother. Someone would also have to break the news to Freud that Google searches, as will be discussed later in this audiobook, sometimes skew toward the forbidden. But still, there are plenty of inappropriate attractions that people have that I would have expected to have been mentioned more frequently in searches. Boss, employee, student, therapist, patient, wife's best friend, daughter's best friend, wife's sister, best friend's wife. None of these confessed desires can compete with mom. Maybe combined with the Pornhub data, that really does mean something. And Freud's general assertion that sexuality can be shaped by childhood experiences is supported elsewhere in Google and Pornhub data, which reveals that men at least retain an inordinate number of fantasies related to childhood. According to searches from wives about their husbands, some of the top fetishes of adult men are the desire to wear diapers and wanting to be breastfed, particularly, as discussed earlier, in India. Moreover, cartoon porn, animated explicit sex scenes featuring characters from shows popular among adolescent boys, has achieved a high degree of popularity. Or consider the occupations of women most frequently searched for in porn by men. Men who are 18 to 24 years old search most frequently for women who are babysitters, as do 25 to 64-year-old men and men 65 years and older. And for men in every age group, teacher and cheerleader are both in the top four. Clearly, the early years of life seem to play an outsized role in men's adult fantasies. I have not yet been able to use all this unprecedented data on adult sexuality to figure out precisely how sexual preferences form. Over the next few decades, other social scientists and I will be able to create new, falsifiable theories on adult sexuality and test them with actual data. Already I can predict some basic themes that will undoubtedly be part of a database theory of adult sexuality. It is clearly not going to be the identical story to the one Freud told, with his particular, well-defined, universal stages of childhood and repression, but based on my first look at Pornhub data, I am absolutely certain the final verdict on adult sexuality will feature some key themes that Freud emphasized. Childhood will play a major role. So will mothers. It likely would have been impossible to analyze Freud in this way 10 years ago. It certainly would have been impossible 80 years ago when Freud was still alive. So let's think through why these data sources helped. This exercise can help us understand why big data is so powerful. Remember, we have said that just having mounds and mounds of data by itself doesn't automatically generate insights. Data size by itself is overrated. Why, then, is big data so powerful? Why will it create a revolution in how we see ourselves? There are, I claim, 4 unique powers of big data. This analysis of Freud provides a good illustration of them. You may have noticed to begin with that we're taking pornography seriously in this discussion of Freud, and we're going to utilize data from pornography frequently in this audiobook. Somewhat surprisingly, porn data is rarely utilized by sociologists, most of whom are comfortable relying on the traditional survey datasets they've built their careers on. But a moment's reflection shows that the widespread use of porn and the search and views data that comes with it is the most important development in our ability to understand human sexuality in, well, Actually, it's probably the most important ever. It is data that Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Freud, and Foucault would have drooled over. This data did not exist when they were alive. It did not exist a couple decades ago. It exists now. There are many unique data sources on a range of topics that give us windows into areas about which we could previously just guess. Offering up new types of data is the first power of big data. The porn data and the Google search data are not just new, they are honest. In the pre-digital age, people hid their embarrassing thoughts from other people. In the digital age, they still hide them from other people, but not from the internet, and in particular sites such as Google and Pornhub, which protect their anonymity. These sites function as a sort of digital truth serum, hence our ability to uncover a widespread fascination with incest. Big data allows us to finally see what people really want and really do, not what they say they want and say they do. Providing honest data is the second power of big data. Because there is now so much data, there is meaningful information on even tiny slices of a population. We can compare, say, the number of people who dream of cucumbers versus those who dream of tomatoes. Allowing us to zoom in on small subsets of people is the third power of big data. Big data has one more impressive power, one that was not utilized in my quick study of Freud, but could be in a future one. It allows us to undertake rapid, controlled experiments. This allows us to test for causality, not merely correlations. These kinds of tests are mostly used by businesses now, but they will prove a powerful tool for social scientists. Allowing us to do many causal experiments is the fourth power of big data. Now it's time to unpack each of these powers and explore exactly why big data matters. 3. Data reimagined. At 6 a.m. on a particular Friday of every month, the streets of most of Manhattan will be largely desolate. The stores lining these streets will be closed, their facades covered by steel security gates, the apartments above dark and silent. The floors of Goldman Sachs, the global investment banking institution in Lower Manhattan, on the other hand, will be brightly lit, its elevators taking thousands of workers to their desks. By 7 a.m., most of these desks will be occupied. It would not be unfair on any other day to describe this hour in this part of town as sleepy. On this Friday morning, however, there will be a buzz of energy and excitement. On this day, information that will massively impact the stock market is set to arrive. Minutes after its release, this information will be reported by news sites. Seconds after its release, this information will be discussed, debated, and dissected loudly at Goldman and hundreds of other financial firms. But much of the real action in finance these days happens in milliseconds. Goldman and other financial firms paid tens of millions of dollars to get access to fiber optic cables that reduce the time information travels from Chicago to New Jersey by just 4 milliseconds, from 17 to 13. Financial firms have algorithms in place to read the information and trade based on it, all in a matter of milliseconds. After this crucial information is released, the market will move in less time than it takes you to blink your eye. So what is this crucial data that is so valuable to Goldman and numerous other financial institutions? The monthly unemployment rate. The rate, however, which has such a profound impact on the stock market that financial institutions have done whatever it takes to maximize the speed with which they receive, analyze, and act upon it, is from a phone survey that the Bureau of Labor Statistics conducts, and the information is some 3 weeks, or 2 billion milliseconds, old by the time it is released. When firms are spending millions of dollars to chip a millisecond off the flow of information, it might strike you as more than a bit strange that the government takes so long to calculate the unemployment rate. Indeed, getting these critical numbers out sooner was one of Alan Krueger's primary agendas when he took over as President Obama's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in 2011. He was unsuccessful. Either the BLS doesn't have the resources, he concluded, or they are stuck in 20th century thinking. With the government clearly not picking up the pace anytime soon, Is there a way to get at least a rough measure of the unemployment statistics at a faster rate? In this high-tech era, when nearly every click any human makes on the internet is recorded somewhere, do we really have to wait weeks to find out how many people are out of work? One potential solution was inspired by the work of a former Google engineer, Jeremy Ginsberg. Ginsberg noticed that health data, like unemployment data, was released with a delay by the government. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention takes 1 week to release influenza data, even though doctors and hospitals would benefit from having the data much sooner. Ginsberg suspected that people sick with the flu are likely to make flu-related searches. In essence, they would report their symptoms to Google. These searches, he thought, could give a reasonably accurate measure of the current influenza rate. Indeed, searches such as flu symptoms and muscle aches have proven important indicators of how fast the flu is spreading. Meanwhile, Google engineers created a service, Google Correlate, that gives outside researchers the means to experiment with the same type of analyses across a wide range of fields, not just health. Researchers can take any data series that they are tracking over time and see what Google searches correlate most with that data set. For example, using Google Correlate, Hal Varian, chief economist at Google, and I were able to show which searches most closely track housing prices. When housing prices are rising, Americans tend to search for such phrases as 80-20 mortgage, new home builder, and appreciation rate. When housing prices are falling, Americans tend to search for such phrases as short sale process, underwater mortgage, and mortgage forgiveness debt relief. So can Google searches be used as a litmus test for unemployment in the same way they can for housing prices or influenza? Can we tell, simply by what people are Googling, how many people are unemployed, and can we do so well before the government collates its survey results? One day, I put the United States unemployment rate from 2004 through 2011 into Google Correlate. Of the trillions of Google searches during that time, what do you think turned out to be most tightly connected to unemployment? You might imagine unemployment office or something similar. That was high, but not at the very top. New jobs? Also high, but also not at the very top. The highest during the period I searched, and these terms do shift, was slut load. That's right. The most frequent search was for a pornographic site. And this may seem strange at first blush, but unemployed people presumably have a lot of time on their hands. Many are stuck at home, alone and bored. Another of the highly correlated searches, this one in the PG realm, is spider solitaire. Again, not surprising for a group of people who presumably have a lot of time on their hands. Now, I'm not arguing based on this one analysis that tracking slut load or spider solitaire is the best way to predict the unemployment rate. The specific diversions that unemployed people use can change over time. At one point, RawTube, a different porn site, was among the strongest correlations, and none of these particular terms by itself attracts anything approaching a plurality of the unemployed. But I have generally found that a mix of diversion-related searches can track the unemployment rate and would be a part of the best model predicting it. This example illustrates the first power of big data, the reimagining of what qualifies as data. Frequently, the value of big data is not its size. It's that it can offer you new kinds of information to study, information that had never previously been collected. Before Google, there was information available on certain leisure activities, movie ticket sales, for example, that could yield some clues as to how much time people have on their hands. But the opportunity to know how much solitaire is being played or porn is being watched is new and powerful. In this instance, this data might help us more quickly measure how the economy is doing, at least until the government learns to conduct and collate a survey more quickly. Life on Google's campus in Mountain View, California, is very different from that in Goldman Sachs' Manhattan headquarters. At 9 a.m., Google's offices are nearly empty. If any workers are around, it's probably to eat breakfast for free. Banana blueberry pancakes, scrambled egg whites, filtered cucumber water. Some employees might be out of town at an off-site meeting in Boulder or Las Vegas, or perhaps on a free ski trip to Lake Tahoe. Around lunchtime, the sand volleyball courts and grass soccer fields will be filled. The best burrito I've ever eaten was at Google's Mexican restaurant. How can one of the biggest and most competitive tech companies in the world seemingly be so relaxed and generous? Google harnessed big data in a way that no other company ever has to build an automated money stream. The company plays a crucial role in this audiobook, since Google searches are by far the dominant source of big data, but it's important to remember that Google's success is itself built on the collection of a new kind of data. If you're old enough to have used the internet in the 20th century, you might remember the various search engines that existed back then, Metacrawler, Lycos, AltaVista, to name a few, and you might remember that these search engines were at best mildly reliable. Sometimes, if you were lucky, they managed to find what you wanted. Often, they would not. If you typed Bill Clinton into the most popular search engines in the late 1990s, the top results included a random site that just proclaimed, "Bill Clinton sucks," or a site that featured a bad Clinton joke. Hardly the most relevant information about the then President of the United States. In 1998, Google showed up, and its search results were undeniably better than that of every one of its competitors. If you typed Bill Clinton into Google in 1998, you were given his website, the White House email address, and the best biographies of the man that existed on the internet. Google seemed to be magic. What had Google's founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, done differently? Other search engines located for their users the websites that most frequently included the phrase for which they searched. If you were looking for information on Bill Clinton, those search engines would find, across the entire internet, the websites that had the most references to Bill Clinton. There were many reasons this ranking system was imperfect, and one of them was that it was easy to game the system. A joke site with the text, "Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton," hidden somewhere on its page, would score higher than the White House's official website. In 1998, if you searched cars on a popular pre-Google search engine, you were inundated with porn sites. These porn sites had written the word cars frequently in white letters on a white background to trick the search engine. They then got a few extra clicks from people who meant to buy a car but got distracted by the porn. What Brin and Page did was find a way to record a new type of information that was far more valuable than a simple count of words. Websites often would, when discussing a subject, link to the sites they thought were most helpful in understanding that subject. For example, the New York Times, if it mentioned Bill Clinton, might allow readers who clicked on his name to be sent to the White House's official website. Every website creating one of these links was, in a sense, giving its opinion of the best information on Bill Clinton. Brin and Page could aggregate all these opinions on every topic. It could crowdsource the opinions of the New York Times, millions of listservs, hundreds of bloggers, and everyone else on the internet. If a whole slew of people thought that the most important link for Bill Clinton was his official website, this was probably the website that most people searching for Bill Clinton would want to see. These kinds of links were data that other search engines didn't even consider, and they were incredibly predictive of the most useful information on a given topic. The point here is that Google didn't dominate search merely by collecting more data than everyone else. They did it by finding a better type of data. Fewer than 2 years after its launch, Google, powered by its link analysis, grew to be the internet's most popular search engine. Today, Brin and Page are together worth more than $60 billion. As with Google, so with everyone else trying to use data to understand the world. The big data revolution is less about collecting more and more data. It is about collecting the right data. But the internet isn't the only place where you can collect new data, and where getting the right data can have profoundly disruptive results. This audiobook is largely about how the data on the web can help us better understand people. The next section, however, doesn't have anything to do with web data. In fact, it doesn't have anything to do with people. But it does help illustrate the main point of this chapter, the outsized value of new, unconventional data, and the principles it teaches us are helpful in understanding the digital-based data revolution. Bodies as data. In the summer of 2013, a reddish-brown horse of above-average size with a black mane sat in a small barn in upstate New York. He was one of 152 one-year-old horses at August's Fassig Tipton Select Yearling Sale in Saratoga Springs, and one of 10,000 one-year-old horses being auctioned off that year. Wealthy men and women, when they shell out a lot of money on a racehorse, want the honor of choosing the horse's name. Thus, the reddish-brown horse did not yet have a name and, like most horses at the auction, was instead referred to by his barn number, 85. There was little that made number 85 stand out at this auction. His pedigree was good, but not great. His sire, father, pioneer of, sick, the Nile, was a top racehorse, but other kids of pioneer of the Nile had not had much racing success. There were also doubts based on how number 85 looked. He had a scratch on his ankle, for example, which some buyers worried might be evidence of an injury. The current owner of number 85 was an Egyptian beer magnate, Ahmed Zayat, who had come to upstate New York looking to sell the horse and buy a few others. Like almost all owners, Zayat hired a team of experts to help him choose which horses to buy. But his experts were a bit different than those used by nearly every other owner. The typical horse experts you'd see at an event like this were middle-aged men, many from Kentucky or rural Florida, with little education but with a family background in the horse business. Zayat's experts, however, came from a small firm called EQB. The head of EQB was not an old-school horseman. The head of EQB instead was Jeff Sater, an eccentric, Philadelphia-born man with a pile of degrees from Harvard. Zayat had worked with EQB before, so the process was familiar. After a few days of evaluating horses, Sater's team would come back to Zayat with five or so horses they recommended buying to replace number 85. This time, though, was different. Sater's team came back to Zayat and told him they were unable to fulfill his request. They simply could not recommend that he buy any of the 151 other horses offered up for sale that day. Instead, they offered an unexpected and near desperate plea. Zayat absolutely, positively could not sell horse number 85. This horse, EQB declared, was not just the best horse in the auction, he was the best horse of the year, and quite possibly the decade. "Sell your house," the team implored him. "Do not sell this horse." The next day, with little fanfare, horse number 85 was bought for $300,000 by a man calling himself Incardo Bloodstock. Bloodstock, it was later revealed, was a pseudonym used by Ahmed Zayat. In response to the pleas of Sater, Zayat had bought back his own horse, an almost unprecedented action. The rules of the auction prevented Zayat from simply removing the horse from the auction, thus necessitating the pseudonymous transaction. 62 horses at the auction sold for a higher price than horse number 85, with two fetching more than $1 million each. 3 months later, Zayat finally chose a name for number 85, American Pharaoh. And 18 months later, on a 75-degree Saturday evening in the suburbs of New York City, American Pharaoh became the first horse in more than three decades to win the Triple Crown. What did Jeff Sater know about horse number 85 that apparently nobody else knew? How did this Harvard man get so good at evaluating horses? I first met up with Sater, who was then 64, on a scorching June afternoon in Ocala, Florida, more than a year after American Pharaoh's Triple Crown. The event was a week-long showcase for two-year-old horses, culminating in an auction not dissimilar to the 2013 event where Zayat bought his own horse back. Sater has a booming, Mel Brooks-like voice, a full head of hair, and a discernible bounce in his step. He was wearing suspenders, khakis, a black shirt with his company's logo on it, and a hearing aid. Over the next 3 days, he told me his life story, and how he became so good at predicting horses. It was hardly a direct route. After graduating magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard, Sater went on to get, also from Harvard, a law degree and a business degree. At age 26, He was working as an analyst for Citigroup in New York City, but felt unhappy and burnt out. One day, sitting in the atrium at the firm's new offices on Lexington Avenue, he found himself studying a large mural of an open field. The painting reminded him of his love of the countryside and his love of horses. He went home and looked at himself in the mirror with his three-piece suit on. He knew then that he was not meant to be a banker, and he was not meant to live in New York City. The next morning, he quit his job. Sater moved to rural Pennsylvania and ambled through a variety of jobs in textiles and sports medicine before devoting his life full-time to his passion, predicting the success of racehorses. The numbers in horse racing are rough. Of the 1,000 two-year-old horses showcased at Ocala's auction, one of the nation's most prestigious, perhaps five will end up winning a race with a significant purse. What will happen to the other 995 horses? Roughly one-third will prove too slow. Another one-third will get injured, most because their limbs can't withstand the enormous pressure of galloping at full speed. Every year, hundreds of horses die on American racetracks, mostly due to broken legs. And the remaining one-third will have what you might call Bartleby syndrome. Bartleby the Scrivener in Herman Melville's extraordinary short story stops working and answers every request his employer makes with, "I would prefer not to." Many horses, early in their racing careers, apparently come to realize that they don't need to run if they don't feel like it. They may start a race running fast, but at some point, they'll simply slow down or stop running altogether. Why run around an oval as fast as you can, especially when your hooves and hocks ache? "I would prefer not to," they decide. I have a soft spot for Bartleby's, horse or human. With the odds stacked against them, how can owners pick a profitable horse? Historically, people have believed that the best way to predict whether a horse will succeed has been to analyze his or her pedigree. Being a horse expert means being able to rattle off everything anybody could possibly want to know about a horse's father, mother, grandfathers, grandmothers, brothers, and sisters. Agents announce, for instance, that a big horse came to her size legitimately if her mother's line has lots of big horses. There is one problem, however. While pedigree does matter, it can still only explain a small part of a racing horse's success. Consider the track record of full siblings of all the horses named Horse of the Year, racing's most prestigious annual award. These horses have the best possible pedigrees, the identical family history as world historical horses. Still, more than three-fourths do not win a major race. The traditional way of predicting horse success, the data tells us, leaves plenty of room for improvement. It's actually not that surprising that pedigree is not that predictive. Think of humans. Imagine an NBA owner who bought his future team as 10-year-olds based on their pedigrees. He would have hired an agent to examine Irvin Johnson III, son of Magic Johnson. "He's got nice size thus far," an agent might say. "It's legitimate size from the Johnson line. He should have great vision, selflessness, size, and speed. He seems to be outgoing, great personality, competent walk, personable. This is a great bet." Unfortunately, 22 years later, this owner would have a 6'2", short for a pro ball player, fashion blogger for E. Irvin Johnson III might be of great assistance in designing the uniforms, but he would probably offer little help on the court. Along with the fashion blogger, an NBA owner who chose a team as many owners choose horses would likely snap up Jeffrey and Marcus Jordan, both sons of Michael Jordan, and both of whom proved mediocre college players. Good luck against the Cleveland Cavaliers. They are led by LeBron James, whose mom is 5'5". Or imagine a country that elected its leaders based on their pedigrees. We'd be led by people like George W. Bush. Sorry, couldn't resist. Horse agents do use other information besides pedigree. For example, they analyze the gaits of two-year-olds and examine horses visually. In Ocala, I spent hours chatting with various agents, which was long enough to determine that there was little agreement on what in fact they were looking for. Add to these rampant contradictions and uncertainties the fact that some horse buyers have what seems like infinite funds, and you get a market with rather large inefficiencies. 10 years ago, horse number 153 was a two-year-old who ran faster than every other horse, looked beautiful to most agents, and had a wonderful pedigree. A descendant of Northern Dancer and Secretariat, two of the greatest racehorses of all time. An Irish billionaire and a Dubai sheik both wanted to purchase him. They got into a bidding war that quickly turned into a contest of pride. As hundreds of stunned horsemen and women looked on, the bids kept getting higher and higher until the 2-year-old horse finally sold for $16 million, by far the highest price ever paid for a horse. Horse number 153, who was given the name the Green Monkey, ran 3 races, earned just $10,000, and was retired. Sater never had any interest in the traditional methods of evaluating horses. He was interested only in data. He planned to measure various attributes of racehorses and see which of them correlated with their performance. It's important to note that Sater worked out his plan half a decade before the World Wide Web was invented, but his strategy was very much based on data science, and the lessons from his story are applicable to anybody using big data. For years, Sater's pursuit produced nothing but frustration. He measured the size of horses' nostrils, creating the world's first and largest data set on horse nostril size and eventual earnings. Nostril size, he found, did not predict horse success. He gave horses EKGs to examine their hearts and cut the limbs off dead horses to measure the volume of their fast-twitch muscles. He once grabbed a shovel outside a barn to determine the size of horses' excrement on the theory that shedding too much weight before an event can slow a horse down. None of this correlated with racing success. Then, 12 years ago, he got his first big break. Sater decided to measure the size of the horse's internal organs. Since this was impossible with existing technology, he constructed his own portable ultrasound. The results were remarkable. He found that the size of the heart, and particularly the size of the left ventricle, was a massive predictor of a horse's success, the single most important variable. Another organ that mattered was the spleen. Horses with small spleens earned virtually nothing. Sater had a couple more hits. He digitized thousands of videos of horses galloping and found that certain gaits did correlate with racetrack success. He also discovered that some 2-year-old horses wheeze after running 1/8 of a mile. Such horses sometimes sell for as much as $1 million, but Sater's data told him that the wheezers virtually never pan out. He thus assigns an assistant to sit near the finish line and weed out the wheezers. Of about 1,000 horses at the Ocala auction, roughly 10 will pass all of Sater's tests. He ignores pedigree entirely, except as it will influence the price a horse will sell for. "Pedigree tells us a horse might have a very small chance of being great," he says. "But if I can see he's great, what do I care how he got there?" One night, Sater invited me to his room at the Hilton Hotel in Ocala. In the room, he told me about his childhood, his family, and his career. He showed me pictures of his wife, daughter, and son. He told me he was one of 3 Jewish students in his Philadelphia high school, and that when he entered, he was 4'10". He grew in college to 5'9". He told me about his favorite horse, Pinky Pizwanski. Sater bought and named this horse after a gay rider. He felt that Pinky, the horse, always gave a great effort even if he wasn't the most successful. Finally, he showed me the file that included all the data he had recorded on number 85, the file that drove the biggest prediction of his career. Was he giving away his secret? Perhaps, but he said he didn't care. More important to him than protecting his secrets was being proven right, showing to the world that these 20 years of cracking limbs, shoveling poop, and jerry-rigging ultrasounds had been worth it. Here's some of the data on horse number 85. Number 85, later American Pharaoh, percentiles as a 1-year-old. Height, 56th percentile. Weight, 61st percentile. Pedigree, 70th percentile. And then, there it was, stark and clear, the reason that Sater and his team had become so obsessed with number 85. His left ventricle was in the 99.61st percentile. Not only that, but all his other important organs, including the rest of his heart and spleen, were exceptionally large as well. Generally speaking, when it comes to racing, Sater had found the bigger the left ventricle, the better. But a left ventricle as big as this can be a sign of illness if the other organs are tiny. In American Pharaoh, all the key organs were bigger than average, and the left ventricle was enormous. The data screamed that number 85 was a 1 in 100,000 or even a 1 in a million horse. What can data scientists learn from SATER's project? First, and perhaps most important, if you're going to try to use new data to revolutionize a field, it's best to go into a field where old methods are lousy. The pedigree-obsessed horse agents whom SATER beat left plenty of room for improvement. So did the word-count-obsessed search engines that Google beat. One weakness of Google's attempt to predict influenza using search data is that you can already predict influenza very well just using last week's data and a simple seasonal adjustment. There is still debate about how much search data adds to that simple, powerful model. In my opinion, Google searches have more promise measuring health conditions for which existing data is weaker, and therefore something like Google STD may prove more valuable in the long haul than Google Flu. The second lesson is that when trying to make predictions, you needn't worry too much about why your models work. SATER couldn't fully explain to me why the left ventricle is so important in predicting a horse's success, nor could he precisely account for the value of the spleen. Perhaps one day horse cardiologists and hematologists will solve these mysteries, but for now it doesn't matter. SATER is in the prediction business, not the explanation business, and in the prediction business, you just need to know that something works, not why. For example, Walmart uses data from sales in all their stores to know what products to shelf. Before Hurricane Francis, a destructive storm that hit the Southeast in 2004, Walmart suspected correctly that people's shopping habits may change when a city is about to be pummeled by a storm. They pored through sales data from previous hurricanes to see what people might want to buy. A major answer? Strawberry Pop-Tarts. This product sells 7 times faster than normal in the days leading up to a hurricane. Based on their analysis, Walmart had trucks loaded with strawberry Pop-Tarts heading down Interstate 95 toward stores in the path of the hurricane. And indeed, these Pop-Tarts sold well. Why Pop-Tarts? Probably because they don't require refrigeration or cooking. Why strawberry? No clue. But when hurricanes hit, people turned to strawberry Pop-Tarts, apparently. So, in the days before a hurricane, Walmart now regularly stocks its shelves with boxes upon boxes of strawberry Pop-Tarts. The reason for the relationship doesn't matter, but the relationship itself does. Maybe one day food scientists will figure out the association between hurricanes and toaster pastries filled with strawberry jam, but while waiting for some such explanation, Walmart still needs to stock its shelves with strawberry Pop-Tarts when hurricanes are approaching, and save the Rice Krispies treats for sunnier days. This lesson is also clear in the story of Orly Ashenfelter. What SATER is to horses, Ashenfelter, an economist at Princeton, may be to wine. A little over a decade ago, Ashenfelter was frustrated. He had been buying a lot of red wine from the Bordeaux region of France. Sometimes this wine was delicious, worthy of its high price. Many times, though, it was a letdown. Why, Ashenfelter wondered, was he paying the same price for wine that turned out so differently? One day, Ashenfelter received a tip from a journalist friend and wine connoisseur. There was indeed a way to figure out whether a wine would be good. The key, Ashenfelter's friend told him, was the weather during the growing season. Ashenfelter's interest was piqued. He went on a quest to figure out if this was true, and he could consistently purchase better wine. He downloaded 30 years of weather data on the Bordeaux region. He also collected auction prices of wines. The auctions, which occur many years after the wine was originally sold, would tell you how the wine turned out. The result was amazing. A huge percentage of the quality of a wine could be explained simply by the weather during the growing season. In fact, a wine's quality could be broken down to one simple formula, which we might call the first law of viticulture. Price equals 12.145 plus 0.00117 winter rainfall plus 0.0614 average growing season temperature minus 0.00386 harvest rainfall. So why does wine quality in the Bordeaux region work like this? What explains the first law of viticulture? There is some explanation for Ashenfelter's wine formula. Heat and early irrigation are necessary for grapes to properly ripen. But the precise details of his predictive formula go well beyond any theory and will likely never be fully understood, even by experts in the field. Why does a centimeter of winter rain add on average exactly 0.1 cents to to the price of a fully matured bottle of red wine? Why not 0.2 cents? Why not 0.05? Nobody can answer these questions. But if there are 1,000 centimeters of additional rain in a winter, you should be willing to pay an additional $1 for a bottle of wine. Indeed, Ashenfelter, despite not knowing exactly why his regression worked exactly as it did,